You're listening to The Christian Commute, a commute-length podcast about Christian apologetics, theology, and other items of Christian interest. Now, broadcasting from an undisclosed location, from the highways and byways, here is your host, Seth Dunn.
This is The Christian Commute for Monday, January 9th. It is the most important day of the entire year. It is the day of the national championship, Alabama versus Clemson. And I'm going home to enjoy this wonderful game. And then I'm going to be tired because they decide, hey, let's make this game at 9 o'clock on a work day. Or 8 o'clock on a work day. Anyway, roll tide. Brother William says that the Tide are going to beat Clemson 30-21. So here's to hoping that Brother William is exactly right. I am fresh off of a trip to seminary. I have just returned from the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, where I went to an apologetics conference to take a course in the historical Jesus. So, if there are any podcasts about the historical Jesus, you'll know why. That's what I'm studying. I hope everyone had a wonderful Christmas break, and I hope everyone had a wonderful beginning to their new year. This is the first Christian Commute for 2017, and I may even get it uploaded before the most important of the events of the night take place, the national championship game. Did I mention Alabama plays one last time? And it's for the national championship. I don't know if I mentioned that, so I won't mention it again. Roll Tide. Now, this is where all you listeners who aren't Alabama fans or don't care about football are like, hurry up! Get to the theology. Okay. Bear with me. My team only gets to play in the national championship once a year. You know, your team might get to play once every 20 years, but mine plays once a year. Anyway, enough with the football talk. Let's get to today's Bible chapter review, today's question from the inbox, and today's show subject. Today's show topic is called The Redcoats and the Viet Cong. But before we get to that, we're going to answer a question in the inbox from Connie in Texas. And before we get to the inbox, we're going to continue our review of 1 Corinthians 11. We are in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 20 through 22. Verses 20 through 22. Paul is rebuking the Corinthians for their behavior. They are meeting together at church to feast, and their eating is not to be confused with taking the Lord's Supper. They're just having a big party with lots of food and drink. And you may be saying, Seth, what's wrong with that? My church has potlucks all the time. Listen, my church had a crock pot dinner to raise money for Lottie Moon, and it was awesome because we had a lot of really good soup, and it was cold that day, and we ate right after church, and we raised money for Lottie Moon. That was great. Here's the thing. Everybody who wanted some got some. Okay, it wasn't an out-of-control party. Here the Corinthians are gathering together as a church, and they're having these big meals, but it's not a communal meal. It's basically the wealthy people feasting and the poor people going hungry. And some people are even coming to church and getting drunk. So imagine somebody showing up at church with a big sack of chicken legs and a bottle of wine, and they drink the whole bottle of wine and eat all these chicken legs. You know, what a wonderful feast they have. But poor people who don't have much food to eat watch them eat, and then they have to put up with some drunk being there. So imagine that. This is what the Corinthians are doing. That's really what they're doing. I know I'm, you know, sometimes I come up with these hypotheticals. They're really showing up to church, having elaborate feasts and getting drunk and not sharing their food. Why do we gather together at church? It's to worship the Lord. If we're going to gather together at church during our corporate meeting, maybe we're going to have the Lord's Supper, which we know, especially in our days, is not a substantial meal. We eat a tiny little wafer and drink a little cup of grape juice. But that is getting together and eating food to worship together and memorialize the Lord. What these people are doing is not that. You know, they're showing up with this big meal, with like a Bojangles tailgate feast, except they're not sharing it. And Paul says to them, do you guys not have homes in which you can eat? Do you really have to come and party and have all of this food in front of these people who are going hungry? There are people who are poor in your church. They're literally going hungry, and you're having this big feast in front of them. What's wrong with you? Can't you eat and drink at home? Why do you have to come and flaunt your wealth at church? So Paul rebukes them. Church is not a place to flaunt our wealth, especially when there's people who don't have much. All right. If you've got somebody in your church who's hungry, you should probably be more concerned with giving them some food than having a good time. By the way, if you're a Christian, it should seem like having a good time to give poor people food, especially your brothers in Christ, right? So the Corinthian church, Paul has observed, is just so disordered. They're disordered in their use of tongues. They're disordered in the way that they have factions. They're a carnal people. They're disordered in discipline. And they're even disordered to the effect that they show up feasting in front of the poor, hungry people and apparently not sharing with them. You know, the other day, my wife wanted some coffee at McDonald's. There's a McDonald's on the way to our church. There's also an Arby's and Wendy's, but she wanted a McDonald's coffee, I think. Or we were running late. There was something where we didn't get any breakfast at home and we had to be there. We have to be on church on time now. Now I teach Sunday school. I just can't show up late to church. Well, oh, I missed the first song. Too bad. No, I have to show up on time to teach class. So I said, well, drive through and get biscuits. So we got biscuits for my kids, like little jelly biscuits from McDonald's, which cost a dollar. And we went in before Sunday school started to eat them in the fellowship hall. And I actually felt bad. I was like, thinking about this verse, I was like, well, we didn't bring biscuits for everybody. What if there's poor people and we're eating these biscuits? And I'm sitting there thinking like, is this okay? Should we be eating these biscuits in the fellowship hall? Maybe we should eat them in the car. What if some hungry person walks by and they don't have any biscuits and my kids have biscuits and they don't? I didn't even have biscuits. I just got $3 worth of biscuits from my kids. And that would have been me being legalistic, I really think, to say, if we're going to have to eat these biscuits in the car, because some people might not have biscuits. But I took this verse very seriously. You want to be in church sharing with people and not letting, you know, flaunting your wealth in front of people. Not that flaunting $3 worth of biscuits from McDonald's is wealthy. But you want to be doing feasting and celebration-like things together and not excluding people. So the next time you stop before church and get McDonald's, just think about that. Don't really think about that, but I was. I guess it's better to err on the side of legalism than, what is it, antinomianism? I never can pronounce that. But yeah, that would have been super legalistic, for real. No, Laura, we are not bringing these biscuits into church to eat the fellowship hall before Sunday school class. All right, so we will continue on with our review of 1 Corinthians 11 tomorrow. I think we'll be talking about the Lord's Supper. But first, let's go, before we go to the today's show topic, let's go to the inbox. SethDunn88@gmail.com. SethDunn88@gmail.com. Do you have a question about apologetics or theology or a show topic suggestion? You can send your questions and suggestions in to SethDunn88@gmail.com. The Christian Commute is your theological roadside assistance. And today, Connie writes in and asks, do we have rights, as in constitutional rights? And rights that we have according to the law, laws of human government. She asks, do we really have these rights? And are these rights biblical? Okay. Well, yes and no is the terrible answer to that. In the United States, the government recognizes a right to privacy that allows a woman to seek an abortion and obtain an abortion. And the government, according to Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court decision handed down in the 70s, says that there is an inherent right to privacy in the Constitution, and it's violating someone's privacy rights to make their abortion procedure illegal. Basically, I'm not a legal scholar, but that's basically what the argument there is. Now, that is a right that is recognized according to the government. This is not a biblical right because we're not allowed to kill innocent people. That's called murder. All right. Babies are made in the image of God, even in the womb, and you're murdering a baby when you procure an abortion. There is no such thing in God's eyes, and by the way, in God's eyes means in reality, because God constitutes ultimate reality. So you can say, in the eyes of the law, in the eyes of the United States Supreme Court, there is a right to procure an abortion. In the eyes of God, no such right exists. So we can't say the right doesn't exist because it's on the books. We see it existing as an abstract object that is enforced and recognized by a government. But it's a counterfeit right at best. It would be unbiblical. So there's an example of a right that the government says that we have, which in the United States, the citizens of the United States, it's recognized. The government can't do anything to them about it. But we don't really have that right. So think of it like this. You may have the right to procure an abortion in the United States, and the government can't punish you. But you don't have a right to escape punishment from God. So in an abstract way, there can exist rights that governments give to people that God has not given them. Rights that do exist but don't exist, to be very confusing. But what about other rights? What about basic natural rights from a Lockean perspective? The right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. All right. When we talk about natural rights. Now, are these biblical rights? Okay, we have them. The United States recognizes them in our Constitution, our life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. It's in the Declaration of Independence. And our government generally recognizes these rights with constitutional rights. But life, liberty, and the pursuit of the property. There's no Bible verse that says, thou shalt have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Okay, so in a way, they're not biblical and they're not prescribed anywhere, but they're not unbiblical. We can see from general revelation that we have these rights. We do have a right to life because God has given us life and we're made in the image of God. So no one has the right to take our life away unless we do something to forfeit our life, say like murdering someone. But inasmuch as we're innocent of any violation of civil law, we have a right to life that no one can take away except for maybe God, because he created life. Liberty. Do we have a right to liberty? Well, God, according to John Locke, and I agree with this, gave the earth to mankind in common. So we're free to do what we want to on this earth as long as it doesn't violate one of God's laws or hurt somebody else. The ultimate law is to love our neighbor as ourselves and love God with our heart, mind, and soul. So if we're doing that, I see us doing that as free creatures, endowed with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. And as long as we're not harming anybody else, we can, or violating the law of God, we do have the right to do those things. Here's a good example. How do we get property? What gives us a property right? Think of a wild apple tree and think of a savage caveman walking around, all right? He picks an apple off that apple tree. What makes that apple his and his property, what gives him a property right, Connie, in that apple, and none of the other caveman can take it from him? Why? Because he used his labor, which he owns. It's the only thing he came into this world owning, was his labor. He used his labor to obtain that apple, so it's his. He has a property right in it. That's where our entire Western idea of property rights comes from. And I don't think it's unbiblical, okay? It's not unbiblical. Now, understand me. There are things that are abiblical, and there are things that are unbiblical. An abiblical thing would be something the Bible just doesn't specifically address. So, is it okay to put a purple collar on your dog? The Bible doesn't talk about what appropriate colors are for dog collars, or it doesn't talk about dog collars in general, all right? So you could say it's not unbiblical to put a purple collar on your dog. It's abiblical. The Bible doesn't say you can't do it. It doesn't go against anything the Bible says, but it's not biblical. So I want to be clear on terms. So when I say that rights are not biblical, I'm not saying they're anti-biblical or I'm just saying they're abiblical or they're not unbiblical, and the Bible is not against them. Okay. So bear with me as I go around this white Ford Explorer that's going way too slow in the fast lane. Is it an expedition and everybody's trying to pass it and he's jacking up traffic. He's got cargo. Like, why are you in this lane? I guarantee you it's an out-of-state driver. I can't see his license plate because of his cargo hatch. All right, now, back on the show. Back on the subject. So, Connie, to answer your question simply, yes, we have rights, and there's nothing unbiblical about our rights, but it doesn't exactly spell them out anywhere. Think about the United States. We have freedom of religion, don't we? That's not a natural right, because God wouldn't violate it if it was. Now, I'm not saying I'm against freedom of religion. I think having a society where you have freedom of religion makes for a prosperous society. But think about it this way. The ancient Israelites didn't have freedom of religion. What do the Ten Commandments say? Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Do not make unto thee any graven image. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. And do not use the Lord's name in vain. All right? Now, there are religions out there that are freely practiced in the United States and protected by the First Amendment that use idols, that don't respect the Sabbath, and that use graven images. All right? So this religious practice is allowed under the First Amendment. So they have the right to do it in the United States, but do they have a natural right to do it? The answer is no. You don't have a natural right to commit idolatry. Idolatry is a gross sin. And it's one that, if you look in Romans chapter 1, it's a sin that leads to other sins. Idolatry. So there's no natural right to idolatry, but practicing an idolatrous religion is legal in the United States. So when you look at the constitutional rights, some of them may comport with a biblical worldview, and some of them may not. So I guess the best way to answer your question is that we do, in fact, have natural rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. And these rights, a case for these rights can be made from general and special revelation, even though they're not spelled out in the Bible. So it's not anti-biblical or unbiblical to say that we have rights. It may be abiblical. But whereas governments, which are ordained by God, according to Romans 14, where our governments say you have a right to X, Y, Z, those rights may be unbiblical. Okay? It doesn't mean that we have to repeal those rights. It doesn't mean the United States has to repeal the First Amendment because idolaters practice idolatry with legal protection under the First Amendment. Okay, so there is a tenuous balance there between rights that actually exist as a part of the natural law and rights that only exist according to some governments but run contrary to God's natural law or God's will. So, Connie, I hope that helps. if you gave me kind of the context and where you're having this conversation or why you were thinking of it, a situation, maybe we could apply this. But no, I don't think rights in general, the concept of having rights, are unbiblical. I just think they could be abiblical. And obviously some rights that some governments say exist don't really exist, and they are in fact sins. Now for the rest of the show, I want to talk about a very important part of being a Christian, especially in today's world. And that is recognizing redcoats and recognizing the Viet Cong. All right, let's do a little short history lesson, okay? It even has to do with rights. In 1776, the forefathers, the founding fathers of the United States of America, said that mankind is endowed with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. And they said, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, provide for the common defense, and promote the general welfare, hereby ordain the United States. All right, I think that's the preamble to the Constitution. And then the Declaration of the Independence is something like, when in human events it becomes necessary. I don't remember all my social studies memorization. Sorry, Mom. My mom's a history teacher and a very patriotic one at that. But we had the American Revolution here in the United States because the Americans felt, our forefathers felt, founding fathers felt, that Great Britain was not recognizing, or their Great Britain's not a country, it's a place. Great Britain's the name of the island. I should say the United Kingdom was not recognizing the rights of American people. They weren't recognizing them, so they said the government's supposed to protect our rights. Instead, they're not protecting them, they're not recognizing them, so we're going to fight a revolution. So that's what they did. And the Continental Army fought the British Army. And what were the British Army called? They were called Redcoats. And here's how war worked in 1776. It was a continental style of warfare, they called it, I think, was the name. So one army would line up on the battlefield, dressed in their uniform, say the Americans would be wearing blue, and then another army would line up on the other side of the battlefield, say the English, wearing red. And you might think to yourself, what kind of crazy army would put its soldiers in red? Everybody can see red. You might think, you know, you want to put your soldiers in camouflage so they can hide in the woods like snipers. Or if they're fighting in the desert, you make them sand-colored. But you don't dress soldiers in red. That's a target. That's not how warfare worked back then. How warfare worked back then was one army lined up on a field, standing opposed to another army, and they could clearly tell who the sides were, and then they shot at each other until the battle was over. So it wasn't a big deal that the Redcoats had red coats on. They had red coats on purpose. They thought they looked nice. Maybe they hid blood on the battlefield. You knew who the enemy was. They wanted to be seen by the enemy on the battlefield, standing across the, you know, across the way from them. And the same thing for the Continental Army. We're looking at them, they're looking at us. Bad guys and good guys are clear. So if you're an American, it's easy to see who the Redcoats were. You just lined up and shot at them. Now let's talk about the Vietnam War. Okay. The Vietnam War is a different kind of war. You have the North Vietnamese Army, which was the communist army in North Vietnam, being supported by the Chinese, and if they had a uniform, it was black pajamas. That's what they called the Vietnamese soldier, the man in the black pajamas. But there was also the Viet Cong, and the Viet Cong were South Vietnamese people who were on the side of the North. But they weren't exactly in South Vietnam dressed in black pajamas, standing on the battlefield, ready to do battle with green-clad American soldiers. They may live in the villages and be dressed like the South Vietnamese people. You see, they're almost like spies. They're enemies in plain sight, but they look like the good guys. And the same could be true today in places like Iran and Afghanistan, where you might have insurgent ISIS or Taliban-type fighters who are dressed exactly like friendly Afghani or Iraqi fighters. They're mixed in. And what am I getting at? It's easy to see who the redcoat is across the battlefield and take aim. It is not as easy when you're in the Vietnamese village to tell who's the loyal South Vietnamese person from the Viet Cong communist who wants to kill you and who's going to shoot you when you turn around, or who's going to disseminate communist propaganda when you leave the village. So I want you to think about this in terms of the church. Where am I going with this? All right? If you're a Baptist like me, it's easy to see who the redcoats are. Muslims, they're redcoats. They're clearly of a different religion. Hindus, that's a redcoat. That's a lost person. They're not on the same side. No, I'm not saying to shoot them. Okay, now, but we're in spiritual warfare, right, against the powers and principalities. Okay, so demonic pagan idolatry manifests itself in false religions like Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam or Jainism or Sikhism. And you can tell who these people are. They're red coats, so to speak. They are obviously of a different religion. And the same goes for the Christian cults, like the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Mormons. Listen, when two guys riding bicycles and white button-up shirts with short sleeves and little name tags that say Elder So-and-So come to your house, you know they're not Christians. You know they're Mormons. And they try to speak Christian, and so do the Jehovah's Witnesses. But Jehovah's Witnesses say, listen, we're from the Watchtower. We're from God's organization. And the LDS missionaries say, we're from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They are clearly dressed for warfare and the uniform of Satan. Okay? They're red coats. In today's Christianity, it's very easy to spot the redcoats. It's the Muslims. It's the Jehovah's Witnesses. It's Scientologists. It's Mormons. Okay? We see them. But what about the Viet Cong? What about the people who dress like us? They look like us. They're in our village. They have the same statement of faith on their website that we have about the Trinity or salvation, but they're not of us. They're Viet Cong. They're the prosperity gospel people. They're the Joel Osteens, Joyce Myers, Christine Keynes, Paula Whites of the world. They're the people predominantly in the black church that call themselves apostles and prophets and then preach a prosperity gospel or put themselves up as some kind of big authority figure to be listened to. They're the people who have a subtle, soft, false gospel. They're Masons. You may have Freemasons at your church. So on Sunday, they dress just like you. They sing the same hymns as you. They study the same Sunday school literature as you. They listen to the same sermon as you. They have the same church membership as you on Sunday. But then on every other Tuesday, they go to the Masonic Lodge and they have people take oaths that say, I'm in darkness seeking light, which no Christian should be able to say. They teach that the name of God is Jabulon, a combination of Jehovah, Baal, and I think Osiris. They teach some kind of strange, esoteric, extra-biblical belief system. They're Viet Cong. They look like Christians, but they're really involved in some kind of false idolatry. And the question becomes, as a Christian, how do you identify and neutralize the Viet Cong? All right? Real easy to identify and neutralize the redcoats. A Muslim will probably never try to join your church. A Muslim will probably never speak at the same Christian conference as your favorite Christian speaker. All right? You'll never see a redcoat at the Continental Congress preaching conference, will you? The Continental Army trade show is not going to feature redcoats. We are actively and visibly at war with each other, and the sides have been drawn. But what about the Viet Cong? Right? Let's take the Passion Conference, for example. where you have a wide array of speakers, where you have someone who's not only website orthodox, but orthodox in what he preaches, like John Piper, who would speak at the Passion Conference. And Charles Stanley shows up at the Passion Conference. But who else is there? Well, Jesus Culture comes from Bethel Redding. Christine Kane from Hillsong and her Prosperity Gospel are there. Beth Moore, the eisegeter, is there. You got Carrie Underwood, gay affirming person, coming out singing about a song about baptismal regeneration. And who put this Passion Conference on? Louis Giglio. Well, you go to his website. Well, he looks like a perfectly orthodox Christian per his website. But why has he invited Christine Kane? Why has he invited Jesus Culture? Or you could be a member of First Baptist Orlando. And up to fill the pulpit, up walks Ben Carson. But Ben Carson's a Seventh-day Adventist. He just kind of looks like one of us, but he's not. He's really from a sub-Christian cult. So the challenge for you, Christian, in today's world, is to identify those Viet Cong people, the people who subtly practice a different religion than you do. Some kind of charismaticism. Some kind of prosperity gospel. But their website is .Christian, not .Muslim. What are you doing, Christian, to keep a lookout for the Viet Cong in your church? I can almost guarantee you that you have some Freemasons in your church. That's a different religion. That's the VC. Muslims across the street at the masjid, at the mosque, are the redcoats. But the Freemasons in your own church are the VC. The charismatics in your own church, who have a bunch of Benny Hinn and T.D. Jakes books at home, are the VC. And let me tell you something. I've been in a church where the charismatics start to creep in. And they look like us, and they talk almost like us. But you can sit there and say, oh, he's VC. He's VC. We got to tell the pastor. The Viet Cong are here. So I'm going to leave you with that thought. What are you doing not to identify the clear cults? Of course, we want to witness to Islamic people. We want to witness to Mormons. We want to witness to Jehovah's Witnesses. But how do we lead the VC who are dressed like us to Christ? Because listen, if you equate shooting at the enemy with sharing the gospel, all right, it's easy to shoot at a redcoat. There's a guy in a redcoat, I'm going to shoot my musket at him. There's a Muslim, I'm going to share Jesus Christ with him. There's a Jehovah's Witness or a Mormon, I'm going to share the true gospel and the true Jesus Christ with these people. I can visibly, easily spot them. All right? But what about the Phineast? What about the charismatic? What about the Freemason? They're in your church. What about that Beth Moore fan? She's in your church. They look like you. Don't forget to share the gospel with these people. They may not be saved. They may be false converts. Now, they may really be saved. It's a lot harder to spot the Viet Cong than the redcoats. But I want to tell you something. It is a greater hazard to not spot the Viet Cong than it is to not spot the redcoats. Listen, the redcoats are not in your own ranks. They're camped somewhere else. Doesn't matter if you don't identify you. They're not ready to stab you in the back. But when you have a double agent in your own camp, when you have a mole in your own camp, that's more dangerous not to see. Because they're hiding in plain sight. And they can destroy your camp very easily. If the redcoats want to destroy your camp, they have to march in, guns ablazing, cannons firing, on horseback, swinging their swords to torch your camp. But if the Viet Cong wants to burn down your village, they just have to wait till you fall asleep and set some fires. But you wouldn't have fallen asleep had you known the enemy was there. You would have been vigilant. So, church, stay vigilant. Christian commuters, stay vigilant. Watch out for the Viet Cong in your midst. Watch out for those double agents. Watch out for those almost Christians. Those are the people who are going to create the factions. And then between, because those factions exist, the truth will be made known. So watch out and be wary. Be wary. No catechism today because I'm not home yet and I don't want to drive while I read and I don't want to drone on. Thanks for listening to the Christian Commute. Let's have a great 2017 together. Keep those questions coming to SethDunn88@gmail.com. Roll Tide.
You're listening to The Christian Commute, a commute-length podcast about Christian apologetics, theology, and other items of Christian interest. Now, broadcasting from an undisclosed location, from the highways and byways, here is your host, Seth Dunn.